This week on the PhDcast, the digital tipping point for Australia, as Deloitte paint a picture of a transformed digital landscape, plus has Channel 10 turned a corner as MasterChef leaves the building and The Bachelor walks in, is the channel at the start of a long sought for resurgence. And finally, global versus local. What is the best way to manage global consistency and local relevance? All of that on the PhDcast from PhD Australia. Hey, welcome, I'm Chris Stevenson and welcome to the PhDcast. This week, I am in a very windswept Melbourne, of all places, where I'm joined by Stuart.
Hello.
And Mark.
Hello.
And Keaton.
Hi.
And Zikan.
Hello.
For a special Victorian edition of the PhDcast, which invites a whole load of jokes, none of which I will even try to go there. Let's get going. The first of this week, a new report by Deloitte shows that Australia is nearing a digital tipping point. This is all reported in the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday, where it says that Australians have well and truly embraced the digital age. A new report has found the proportion of Australians owning three electronic devices, smartphone, tablet, laptop, is now at 53%. What's amazing is that is almost a doubling from 28% last year. They call these people digital omnivores, and they suggest we are at a digital tipping point, a point of which we're a shift. We go from analog into on-demand from a TV point of view, and from online as opposed to print consumption of newspapers. Are we at a tipping point in Australia when it comes to digital media consumption?
Well, the only news to me is the fact that there's a news article saying we're at a digital tipping point. I would have thought we're way beyond that. I think and that obviously depends on demographic, but if you look at the way anyone under 30, particularly under 20, is consuming their media, their tipping, I don't even think they had a tipping point. They just grew up digital, and it just is that way. So I must admit, I'm a little surprised that it's newsworthy.
Yeah, I think it's actually, you know, when you're looking at something like a tipping point, generally it's around actually the 20 to 30% mark. So when you get to the halfway mark, it's the, like, really, it's a mass market stage. And like Mark said, you know, you've got the younger people that's the adoption rate is way beyond 50%.
So, yeah, I mean, up to 70%. So amongst younger age viewers, so amongst 14 to 30-year-olds, 70% choose to watch the internet. Choose to watch internet television instead of TV.
Yeah.
Do you know that the most important word in that is choose? Because that's what it comes down to. I mean, people in this day and age, when they have choice, do not sit there and watch their content when media owners choose to serve it to them. They do it in their own time. That's all the technology is. It's an enabler that enables them to exercise that choice. And that's what they do. I mean, I think there's an entire demographic, a younger demographic, that doesn't even draw the distinction between TV, PC, tablet, mobile. They don't even think like that. It's just their content, and they'll choose to digest it in whatever form is readily available
and
that works for them.
Digital omnivore allows that choice to happen.
Absolutely.
So the tipping point is literally just over 50% of people are now omnivores for digital mediums. So that just means, I guess, that they can choose to watch something on a tablet or a TV, but something we all have in common in every country is we've all got 24 hours every day, and we're only awake for, well, 12 if you're in advertising, but probably 8, 9, 10 hours a day. So that just means that, you know, we have to choose how to spend that time, and there is a tipping point in terms of media consumption.
I find one of the most interesting ones that 72% of people are binge-watching, so sitting down and watching multiple episodes in a row. I think that's an interesting trend that you can't do that on, you know, with your average set-top box. So that's, I find, one of the most interesting.
And it is easy to look at the Breaking Bads or the Game of Thrones, and it's easy to look at those kind of shows. House of Cards is another one, and say, yeah, but that's just a certain age group. It's just a certain behaviour. It's the exception that proves the rule. It's no longer the exception that proves the rule. It's now very much the rule for 72% of Australians.
Yeah, it's what goes on in during, like, you know, when we go out for dinner. That's what people talk about. And if you actually look at the commercial TV. And yeah, in your house, you know, in my house, when we are sitting down and watching TV, what happens during the commercial? where I'll on Facebook checking in and looking at what's going on. Facebook just proved the figure was 78% of like Facebook users actually, you know, check Facebook while they're watching TV.
I think I mean this opens up an entire interesting area, and just thinking through it while we're talking, this to me, this is where the tipping point is. The tipping point isn't in analog versus digital. The tipping point is the blurring of lines between platforms that people choose to graze or consume their content. You know, even in our own rhetoric, in our own categories of the way we look at media, we have TV, we have online. I mean, if I'm on Facebook consuming a 30-second film, call it a TV, it's not a TVC, it's a film, where does that sit? How do I categorise that? Is it TV expenditure? Is it online expenditure? And the reality is it doesn't matter.
Mm.
And we're going to have to seriously think about how we recategorise everything that we talk about in this industry.
And I was going to ask about that, because this is the third year that Deloitte have run the report, which allows them to start making some predictions. And the predictions are pretty stark. It suggests a demise for TV in favour of online in the next 12 months. 26% of people will watch most, if not all, of their content downloaded or streamed. 32% will watch a mix of physical and digital media within 12 months. What are the kind of implications for broadcasters, and what kind of structural change are we looking at in the media broadcast industry as a result of these changes in consumption and this fluidity between screens?
I wouldn't profess to have all the answers to that, but I mean, deeply, a big part of that is actually the word broadcast. Like I said, I mean, the fact that people... I mean, that newspapers are going the same way. The fact that people think... The media owners think that people want to consume media when they're ready to serve it to them or broadcast it to them, it's just not the way it's going to be.
Mm.
It's just not. So people will exercise that choice, and I'll use technology and different platforms to exercise that choice.
Yeah. And what are the implications for planning? Because from a planning point of view and from the discipline of using media to reach people with communications... How good are we? How much are we keeping pace with not just adding channels together, but fluidly distributing content in and across screens, which is what we now need to be able to do? How at pace are we with that?
Well, in an online environment, I know that when I send video out, we always ask for the highest resolution video possible, because what happens is we don't know where someone's going to consume that. Our ad server transcodes that down to multiple different sizes and bit rates depending on the internet. It does get a bit complicated, but it is available there on any device that anyone wants to watch it on. And we have to think about now when we're watching banners, when we're creating banners, that some people might have high resolution displays, and that's where Facebook's taken that really innovative approach where they say, it's not really an ad size anymore you have to give us.
Yeah,
Amazingly, because of my DoubleClick certification, I understood more than 40% of that, which is pretty good.
As planners, I think when decisions get made in a boardroom with our clients, we actually need to be brave enough to say, hey, this is a reality, this is what's happening. It's no longer about test and learn or 5% of your budget towards a new channel. It's actually, we're quite behind. And even though it feels uncomfortable doing, those are the, like, you know, we really got to be where the eyeballs are, where people are actually engaging with their content instead.
And Stuart, the guys mentioned Facebook Video. Keaton mentioned Facebook Video. You were there yesterday, and you got some news from yesterday, right?
That's right. Well, currently, sort of, a lot of the Facebook talk is about plugging the gaps with your across your traditional media holes. So that's where the technology is at. A lot of your Facebook advertising, you know, you can target people at specific times when, you know, they might not be on watching TV.
Which you could argue is a pretty conservative play. With the kind of figures we're looking at for a digital publisher like Facebook to be saying, fill your broadcast holes as propositions go. It's conservative,
it's
right?
It's the opposite, yeah, yeah. That's right. So I find that very interesting. And I think that's this is the trend that we can use.
And here's the thing, like, just from that, right? Advertisers actually need to be a bit, like, really, we need to be on the ball with what kind of content that we're producing, right? Because it comes in, it came down back down to choice, that people can actually choose what to watch and what not to watch. So as far as 30-second commercials go, it actually needs to you know, have a bit more content, and like it needs to be engaging. You know, it's no longer about us, it's actually about you who's sitting in front of the screen, and what do you care about?
Oh no, I relate this back. My daughter's 15, nearly 16, and if we were trying to reach her with a traditional television approach, you wouldn't.
It would be invisible, right?
She wouldn't see it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not how she consumes media and content. Full stop.
There is one place which I found television still has a very important part, and that is if a premium brand is not shown at least once on a television, there is this perception that the brand has lost a bit of authenticity, or it's not as premium as maybe its competitors who can afford to advertise on TV. So that's why I guess sometimes you have to think about perception as well.
I agree with that. And I'm not for a second heralding the death of free-to-air TV. Yeah. But my point is that the younger demographic, the younger you are typically, the more technologically, digitally capable you are, and they're, you know, in 20 years' time, they're going to be 25, smack in the middle of 25 to 54s.
Yeah. And as planners, for us to be a part of the change, I think we have to be vulnerable in front of our clients.
To get more on the digital tipping point, that was in City Morning Herald, or search for that report from Deloitte Media Consumer Service. Up next, a big week for Ten. This week saw The Bachelor back as MasterChef leaves, and also the Commonwealth Games in full swing. It could be argued Ten hasn't had the best of runs of late, and this was very, very welcome news in the boardroom of Ten, Mark, right?
They're pretty happy at the moment, yeah. I mean, it's a long climb out. This isn't going to change in a short period of time. They know that. This is really, you know, good signs. They've got some good shows. MasterChef did well. Con Games is in a good place. Family Feud has started pretty well. You know, they've got some this, and it does become self-perpetuating, because one of the biggest problems they've had is their inability to self-promote. So if no one's watching programs, it's very hard to promote other programs. So they need a couple of high-rating properties in order to do that, and they'll be very happy that they're starting to see some of those happen.
And from your guys' perspective, you guys are more playing in the digital sense. I mean, what kind of role do you see Ten playing in terms of an online or from a broader platform play perspective?
Well, they've made headway with their Ten Play app going cross devices. I mean, obviously SBS is always at the forefront with ABC, but they're doing a lot more in that space than some of the other channels. So they are thinking ahead. And we have run a few campaigns through that, which has been successful. So when I think of doing catch-up with a campaign, Channel 10 comes to mind on top of, let's just say, Channel 7.
Let's just say. And in terms of MasterChef out, Bachelor in, how important are these shiny floor shows as they've come through? How important are those for schedules now? And are not just Ten, but are all networks perhaps over reliant on shiny floor as a genre?
Anyone got a view on that?
I don't really know.
I'm just putting it out there.
I mean, I just
relate. Ask the hard-hitting questions.
My life, and like, to be honest, the times I watch like a MasterChef show is the time I would be having dinner and sit in front of the TV.
Do you compare, like, what's on your plate and what's on the?
Yeah, well, I normally do a better job.
I think I'm not sure about the shiny floor shows. I think the formats can change fairly drastically. But I do question where food is at the moment. You know, food, we've seen a big emergence of food with My Kitchen Rules particularly and MasterChef. How many they've got left in them, I'm not sure. Probably less than we've seen, no doubt. But when it stops being food and starts being something else, because typically it'll come in cycles, there is something else. I think we're nearing the end of that cycle.
Personally. Yeah, I was in the UK when the food... shows started over there, and there was a famous book at the time called Bad Food Britain, and how everyone was idolising food and at the same time eating really bad food while they were watching amazing food being cooked. But in Australia, that came, and I think maybe let's look at the UK and see what's coming across next. I mean, let's face it, it does happen, and it starts over there.
Yeah, I think, like, food is an interesting one because it's part of, you know, it's always going to be part of our lives. It's the personalities behind the food programs that makes it interesting. So as long as they can continue to reinvent themselves and have personalities behind it, and instead of, like, you know, going for the same format, I actually think that food, you know, can be ongoing.
It's got some miles,
still got some miles
it.
Behind
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And shows like MasterChef and shows like it, that they are just the descendants of shows that have gone for decades before them, whether it's the Big Brothers of the noughties, and even before that, those big nighttime game shows of the 80s and 90s. It's like, it's just the monocle. There's always been a place for those big event audience
work.
Shows, right?
I purchased Heston's sausages at Coles last week.
How were they?
They were okay. They were average, but I mean, Heston.
Are they okay or are they average?
They were pretty average, but it's what
it's
Heston.
Like, it's like breaking news now in the world of YouTube.
It's what Heston's name did to me at that point in time, and I didn't think it did affect me until I saw his face on a sausage and I bought it.
Like a miracle. It was like, oh, it's Heston's face.
I think one thing that they are doing well is placement and content. I think they are. It is a great, you know, the format lends itself fantastically well to that, and I think they're doing that really well. And I think they kind of have to in a way because, in fact, there was a Fin Review article on Monday that I happened to be in, actually, and the comment I made, which is important to the topic, was that, you know, supermarkets are a genuine competitor to television because as they force manufacturers to drop prices, it comes straight out of their advertising budgets. Yep. So I think it's fantastic to see the 10 networks of the world, of the industry, I should say, provide those formats where they can continually, you know, attract that kind of money.
Mm. Yeah.
And the same too of Recipe to Riches and all those kind of things where retail integration is becoming more and more prominent. And especially, I suppose, as e-commerce gains traction, that the idea of retail integration will only become more prominent, whether it's in online or in social areas as well.
Yeah, I definitely can see more brands creating content or shows that's around their, you know, whatever that they're doing. So it's only beneficial because like it beats a 30-second commercial.
But back to the top of the story, 10. You know, it is good to see 10 starting to show some shoots. They're a long way from out of the woods, but it's good signs, and it's great. We want and need three competitive networks.
Yeah,
and that's important from an advertising and trading perspective. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. From a cost point of view, from a trading point of view, from a leverage point of view, as advertisers and as media buyers, three commercial networks is the best possible place to be in that regard. Two strong networks and a whipping boy is not where we want to be, not where anyone wants to be.
Not in TV and trading, nor in life.
No.
And finally, this week on the pages of Mumbrella, Jörg Dietzel, who's Audi's German boss, is contemplated on the challenge of a global brand, activating locally. He said, it's funny, a long time ago, he built a network of agencies for Audi out of London. He was in a centre position and was always getting upset about markets that were doing other things differently. Now, he's in the local market, he says he sees things differently. It's an interesting perspective on global brands versus local brands. Here in Melbourne, we plan for brands that are centralised elsewhere. We also plan for big brand that's centralised right here. And so, arguably, this office has the global and local perspective from both angles. Is there a right answer? Is there a best way in terms of brand planning, when you're connection planning, when you're media planning for brand? What's the hunch? Central control or local freedom?
I don't think there is a right or wrong, number one. And I think it's just where you stand as a brand, right? Like, we're living in an age of two-way conversations. And I think being a local brand really encourages that, because as a person, it's much more relatable when it's being local. But if you want to be a brand that kind of just be in the space of this is who we are, come and see us if you want, and that's fine also. But I don't think there's a right or wrong.
I think, yeah, coming off the back of that Facebook event that we were discussing earlier, the big talk there was relevance to your audience, and I think there's no way that you can track that from, you know, a global perspective. It can be very difficult. So the local knowledge is very important.
I'm with Zcan on this. One size doesn't fit all. But you know, we've all seen them. Either on TV or in cinema, the big global petrochemical, you know, global 60-second TVC, and it just looks and smells like a global 60-second TVC with no local relevance whatsoever.
That your daughter will never see.
That she'll never see. Well, she goes to the movies, so she might. So I think there's extremes, and then the other extreme, I'm sure, and I don't have examples, but there are brands that are completely schizophrenic in every, you know, they're different in every market they operate. I think there's middle ground. I think there's global parameters and local interpretation. You know, and if we are going to engage with local cultures and local people, there has to be that.
Yeah, I think Volkswagen's done a pretty good job in localizing their brands.
Yeah.
Each country, if you go to Asia or America, it looks quite different in its brand position.
And even, I think the globalization is making the world a smaller place. And there should just be one golden rule, that globalization can sometimes disrespect the customer in a way that we would never choose to do. And spending time to understand the culture and talking to them in their native language and being more culturally relevant can have wonderful, beneficial effects that other brands would not see. If you had native speakers in a media agency and it wasn't an overseas media agency and you're working in Korea, if you bring an ad overseas that doesn't speak to them, it can be disrespectful.
And there's great examples of that, I think. I mean, McDonald's are a very good example. McDonald's, globally, McDonald's. They look like McDonald's, they smell like McDonald's. It is McDonald's everywhere you go. But I guarantee there's no other market that has the McAussie burger.
Or we name themselves Maccas.
Correct. Within global brand parameters.
And when I see an ad that's dubbed, but you can clearly tell it's been filmed in America and it's an American family, I just know that there's no thought put into that for the Australian audience.
And there's a lot of talk recently for the Samsung ad, the Australian Samsung ad, which I've heard a few people talk about just because it seems they've just got it so right from capturing that Aussie sentiment, that Aussie approach to life from the soundtrack all the way through to the things they talk about in the ads, and they've got really right locally.
Yeah. And on the other side of the spectrum, if you look at Dove or Apple, they've actually done a pretty good job on an emotional level, but have a global position.
And from a social media perspective, in terms of how a brand will have a consistent conversation globally, but also from a social point of view, is having very local conversations. How do you even begin to navigate that or go about making sure you deliver on both of those?
Well, that's one of the great things about the new age is that we can look at our audience and, you know, look at the percentage that are of one particular, perhaps ethnicity or certain interests, age groups, and we can target our ads and the content we serve based on those attributes, which is, you've never really been able to get so niche before. It's a great period to be working.
On which, though, I think of no better way to kind of wind things up. It's never been a better time. That's it for this week. A big thank you to participants Stuart.
Thank you.
And Mark.
Thank you.
And Keaton.
Thank you.
And Zcan.
Thank you.
I've been Chris Stevenson, and one very big congratulations to PhD Australia, the vast majority of which got Double Click certified this week. So well done us. I almost know what it means. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
To get more from PhD Australia, you can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter or find us on Google Plus @PhD Australia.